So within all those projects that were kind of in my intro there, I'm mostly just going to be talking about the Line 3 struggle and things like that. I'll say up front that while I'm a union organizer organizing factory workers in rural Minnesota, there is no correlation to the Line 3 work, sadly, right now between those things, and that's something that'll be exciting to figure out. But I wanted to start out real quick with a land acknowledgement. I live in Minnesota, so it's different Native folks there, so forgive me if I'm pronouncing some of these wrongs, but we are on stolen land. It's all stolen Native land in North America. This is the land of the Council of Three Fires, which is the Ojibwe people, Ottawa people, and Potawatomi. I think I'm pronouncing that right.
Potawatomi.
Thank you. You're right. I threw the syllables in there. And for some context, too, did anyone go to the talks from Red Nation or from Ben Ward on settler colonialism?
Yeah.
Great, awesome. So those are really good points of reference. Folks should talk to the Red Nation folks. You should read Ben Ward's books. Did the Red Nation folks have books for sale? I don't think so. So you should find them and talk to them. They are probably a lot more able to focus on decolonization aspects than I think I will be able to personally. So for some context, what we literally do on the ground, right, is try to fight a pipeline, and the broader context of that is what pipeline and why and things like that. And I think the context that's worth drawing out for that is the global North American continent, US and Canada, and then Minnesota kind of like picture that is painted of like why we are fighting this pipeline the way we are fighting it in a certain sense. So globally, right, it's climate change and the climate crisis. How many people have heard of tar sands? Great, perfect, that's awesome. It's really bad, right? The short version, it's the worst of the worst of the worst. As far as extraction in North America, I'm sure there's grosser, deadlier extraction in particularly colonized countries in the global south. But as far as North America, it's the worst. And it's the worst for climate. It's the worst for the actual ecosystems right then and there. It's the worst for the workers. It's the worst for the native people in Canada who are facing the diseases and cancers coming from this type of extraction. But in particular, tar sands expansion, the expansion of the tar sands industry, which means, killing acres and acres of ecosystems, for over large tracts of land, right, means also massive emissions of carbon dioxide and maybe methane. I'm not sure where that falls in, right? So globally, that's the context. And that means that we have a very specific, concrete infrastructure project that we could be fighting locally in the United States and in Canada that has a massive global impact. So that's like one layer of it, right? And then getting into like, where is it? Tar sands in Alberta, Canada. Anyone know how large of an area the tar sands is already completely wiped out? Any like guesses? It's basically the size of the Great Britain, the whole island, which I'm not sure how many miles it is, but that's how much has already been destroyed. I'll say too that because of the delays in Line 3, because Line 3 did not go on the get done as fast as Enbridge wanted it to, because of that in particular, there has been a multi-million dollar tar sands expansion project that was canceled several months ago, which means we've already stopped the expansion of the tar sands industry once in a really concrete way. Yeah, barely anyone talked about it. Like, it barely got any news attention, but like a huge, that's actually the victory we're looking for, is it's stopping a pipeline, so we stopped tar sands, right? The pipeline is just the middle thing. So in Canada, there are tons of people fighting tar sands oil pipelines because there's, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, at least kind of five main ones is the short version. Line 3 and Keystone XL are the two, I think maybe Line 5, somebody in Michigan can correct me if that's, I'm pretty sure that's tar sands pipeline, right? Those are the ones that go through the United States. In Canada, there is the Northern Gateway Pipeline, the Trans Mountain Pipeline, and the Energy East Pipeline. All of those are being resisted by Indigenous people in particular in Canada in some really inspiring ways. I would suggest people look up the Unistoten people. I'm not sure how to spell that off the top of my head, but at the end people can ask about it. But they've been hosting action camps and doing civil disobedience and direct actions against these pipelines for years now, for years. And they've made serious victories in stopping and delaying a lot of these pipelines. The government of Canada just bought, I think it was Energy East, no, it was Trans Mountain Pipeline, I'm pretty sure. It was one of these pipelines that was the company was going to pull out because it was no longer profitable. And so Justin Trudeau was like, no, we want to save this. We'll buy it. And the government bought it so that they can try to finish it. But that's how close this thing was to cancellation. And that's how progressive Trudeau's government is. So in Canada, these things are being fought. There are really beautiful, inspiring indigenous-led movements fighting these things. So then we get down here, right? And there was a big fight against KXL. How many people in this room were like part of the KXL fight at one time in your life or not, right? This is kind of a while ago, like 5-6 years ago at least, and you know, before that too. Yeah, right, exactly. Like it was a hot minute, and that thing is delayed right now in a pretty good way. It's in a moment where we want to keep it in stasis and not moving. But line three is kind of the next one. And line three, you might hear it referred to as a replacement pipeline, because there is already an existing line three, and it's completely corroded and it's leaking in a bunch of spots. And they're like, let us replace this. But what they really mean is we're going to leave the old one in the ground, and right next to it, we're going to build a brand new one with a way higher capacity for way more oil. So what they're doing is building a brand new pipeline and leaving the old leaking one in the ground. And they have no qualms about that. And that's the one that's going through Minnesota. It's not just going through Minnesota. People can shout out other states it's going through if I'm missing some, but I'm assuming it comes through North Dakota, into Minnesota, and then Wisconsin and Michigan. Oh, probably just, I think it ends in Wisconsin. Line three ends in Wisconsin, line five is in Michigan. So the trick is, it's already done in North Dakota, and it's already done in Wisconsin. There was some really great resistance to it, particularly in Wisconsin in the last several years, but it's finished. Minnesota is the last stand we have against this pipeline, as far as geography goes, right? And as far as most of us probably aren't going to go into Canada to fight the pipeline, we're probably going to be focused on it here, right? Minnesota is the last place we can beat the thing. There's no other states left. And they kind of got to Minnesota last because it's going to be the hardest one for them. It's the most, the vast majority of the pipeline, as far as what's in the U.S., goes through Minnesota. But on top of that, it's a slightly more dangerous political climate. I think Enbridge, the company behind it, is pretty cognizant of that. So just want to kind of start at that level of the kind of land scale we're dealing with is like North America, the United States, Minnesota, but then globally for climate change, right? So how do you build a fight on this thing at that scale, right? Is there a global fight? Is it a local fight? And the answer is probably that it's all of it, right? But at the very least, what actually exists is it's a fight at the level of, you know, Canadian tar sands expansion and pipelines, and then in Minnesota, and there has been fights by Native folks and other allies in Wisconsin and North Dakota. So that's a little context. The kind of strategies is kind of what I want to go into as far as like what do we actually do about it and what are we actually doing about it very concretely, because to me that's what's useful. It's like this is how we're actually doing it. This is how we actually see it going. This is what we want to do, and I will invite you all to come do it with us. So I'm from Northfield Against Line 3. Northfield, Minnesota is in southern Minnesota. We're about 4 hours away kind of from the nearest point of the pipeline, which, hey, that's a lot closer than we were to Standing Rock. That was like 10 hours away easily. So like this thing pretty much in our backyard. From Minneapolis and St. Paul, the nearest point of the pipeline is like roughly 3 hours away. It also is all the way in the corner of northwestern Minnesota, so you can drive many hours to, like, it takes, you know, day and a half or whatever to drive the whole pipeline route. But nonetheless, we're pretty close as far as the Twin Cities goes. So in Northfield, though, why would we do that? Because we have a collective of radicals. We're organizing a lot of other things that were listed in my intro earlier, right? We're doing that anyways, and we're like, this is a critical climate fight. And as radicals, we think this is not only a critical climate fight that we need to defeat in order to have a fighting chance for the climate, whatever we make of if there's any chance at all for, you know, preserving ecology on the planet at this point. But like, if we're going to do anything on the offense to like build new systems, we also have to beat this thing because it's the worst of the worst. And we can beat it because they're on the ropes, which is really cool. We can talk about that later. But so in Northfield, we see this really as an opportunity to be in solidarity with anti-colonial struggles led by Native folks in northern Minnesota and across Canada. That's one critical function of it. So like, you know, solidarity with Indigenous people, climate fight, and then on top of that, it's an opportunity to build a mass movement and build a mass base and radicalize thousands of people. And not only radicalize them, right, but actually teach them skills and how to fight. And that's the big thing. It's like we can all have radical analysis, right? But that does not mean that that translates to skills in building movements and organizing and direct action. And to us, this is a huge opportunity to do that. So it's not just a fight because we should do it, but it's a fight because what a great opportunity to build a mass movement in a mass space. So to do that, we kind of keep in mind a couple strategies. So like there's a legal strategy, right, where the courts hopefully delay and stuff. That's great. Sierra Club and some of the reservations that have people suing, and like that's great. They don't really let us into that. Not just us, like that's not like a movement space necessarily. There's not like they aren't, you know, we could offer to go to the judges' houses and do protests there, but like the lawyers doing the legal stuff aren't usually about that. They don't think it would work well. So like, hopefully some legal things work in the courts. That'd be nice. So what does that leave us? That leaves us legislative things, like with the governor and the lieutenant governor, who are both Democrats, who, you know, campaign on a climate policy, and then they go around and do nothing to stop this pipeline in Minnesota. And then it leaves actually getting in front of the pipeline construction. And this, the name of the game, right, is delay, delay, delay. Because we are not strong enough as a left or as a climate justice movement to stop a pipeline permanently in its tracks with the amount of people we have. So the name of the game is we delay construction through, hopefully the courts, but we can't rely on it. We don't know how it's going. Maybe the legal system through doing a stay of construction, the governor could do that, or denying the permits at the level of different government agencies. And last but not least, getting in front of the actual construction with our bodies, right? So delay, delay, delay. And with enough delays, it eventually becomes not financially viable. They're not going to make profit on it. The company pulls out, or the investors pull out, or the shippers pull out. That's how some pipelines have been beaten before. But it is delay, right? It's a long-term fight. It's a war of attrition, and that we have to be super ready for that. And like, that's what we have to build for the long term. And we have to do it on their timeline. Their timeline is, they say they're doing pre-construction right now, which means they're not literally laying pipe, although they are literally laying pipe, just not in most places. They're just doing it on some of the reservations where they have different permitting. For most of the thing, they're clear-cutting forest, they are building access roads, and they're building utility power lines, because they actually have to flow electricity through the thing, through the pumps, to get the oil to flow. And so you have to build power line corridors alongside it. So that's the construction they're doing right now. They call it pre-construction. Pre-construction is construction. It's all part of the same damn pipeline. So it's a really great intervention point for us. These machines are a little less scary to walk yourself to than pipeline laying machines in big pits. So it's a really good intervention point right now to intervene in pre-construction. But what they say, Enbridge, the company, is they say in January, they'll expect to have all their permits to actually start putting the pipeline in the ground and crossing underneath rivers. I don't remember how many rivers and waterways this crosses under, but the answer is a lot, including like the Mississippi and all these things. So they want to cross under all these things. And when they have that, they say that about 6 months between like January or February or March, when they kind of start construction, and then the middle of 2020, so roughly June, they're like oil flowing middle of 2020. So that means we have like January through June as like the time that we need to be the most escalated, the most people on the front lines, the most people doing urban mass direct action on the government, on the banks financing the thing, things like that. Like, that's our timeline. And that's a really short version of the timeline. There's some other components, right? So a few other things that we're talking about in this is like, this movement is made of like real people. It's just, it's grassroots people. They're like the nonprofits involved in some of them are doing great stuff, but on the whole, there's a lot of Native leadership from the Fond du Lac Reservation. And what does Native leadership mean, right? It's like, it's not the tribal council, it's not the elected governments, it's not a lot of things, and it is a lot of things, and it's complicated and messy is one of the things it is. And this is the thing, I think, you know, getting into like solidarity with anti-colonial struggles and decolonization is that, as a bunch of, for us in Northfield, we're mostly white, and for a lot of the kind of allies around the struggle, we're mostly white. And so how are we, you know, doing that solidarity, and whose leadership are we following, and things like that? Those are really active questions for us that we're navigating all the time. And what it comes down to is, let's have face-to-face, real, normal human relationships with like the Native people resisting the thing, who we literally meet and talk to and treat like human beings. And we're like, so what do you want to do? And what do you want us to do? But it's also accepting that there's going to be Native folks who are completely pro-pipeline, right? Including a bunch of the governments, totally pro-pipeline. Or in a lot of cases, honestly, the governments approved the pipelines on the reservations, but they feel bad about it. And there's complicated reasons for that and whatnot, but like, that doesn't do anything for us. Like, that's the problem, is that doesn't stop the pipeline for the governments to feel bad about it. So like, we work with grassroots activists who are against the pipeline, whose politics align with us. You know, if we're being real, we're not, Native people are not a monolithic block of belief about pipelines and climate change, right? So Fond du Lac has a lot of leadership that we follow. There's an indigenous collective everyone should follow on Facebook and Instagram called GNEW, which is G-I-N-E-W, the GNEW Collective. That's a group of mostly Anishinaabe women, but also Native folks kind of from around Turtle Island, who have joined up to form this kind of affinity group and a collective. That they're scouting the pipeline, they're doing direct action with the pipeline, and they're able to host camps where we fight the pipeline, where we kind of go up for a couple days, and then we, you know, do a direct action on the pipeline. What's a direct action? That's where we directly act on the pipeline, right? We're not asking the governor to stop the pipeline. We're not pressuring Enbridge to stop the pipeline. That's protest, right? We're saying, hey, please, big bad guys, stop doing this. We're saying, we're going to go stop the pipeline, right? And, like, that's not a value judgment. Like, we're also prioritizing a lot of protests where we're asking the bad guys to stop. But in the meantime, we know that to build up the layers of skill and people and confidence and experience that in January through June, right, that timeline, to have thousands of people doing that kind of action. Right now, we need dozens and hundreds to come learn how to do that on the front lines in smaller groups so that we can get to the scale we need to of escalation later in the timeline. So learning to do direct action right now on the pre-construction is critical while we're also pressuring the governors and things like that. I think I'll kind of wrap it up there. I could say more afterwards and kind of closing. I'm just going through my little thing here to see if I'm missing anything absolutely critical. Nothing. See, I can say more as to kind of a lot of that, but long and short of it is we think our job for anti-colonial solidarity is to build an army of people to go assist the frontline Native leadership who have said, we want to stop this pipeline, come help us. And we're like, great, we're going to build a giant base of skilled, radicalized, militant not meaning, armed, militant meaning combative and aggressive and like escalated, right? We're willing to take escalated action, nonviolent escalated action. So we see that as our job. There's a lot of logistics in that. There's a lot of roles in that aren't about getting arrested, like primarily. Oh my gosh, I'm that's what we're after. There's a whole movement of that we'd love to talk about. And the last thing I'll say is July 26th through July 29th, so the end of July, please come join us. We are holding these camps, right, where we do training on direct action, on strategy. We may or may not do actions, right, where we go stop the pipeline. It literally depends on if they're doing construction that day and if it's nearby. If it's 400 miles away, it's hard to do. But that's a public camp. We've done a lot of these camps secretively with just trusted comrades. This is a fully public one. There will be a Facebook event. And if you'd like to come to that camp or any future camps, we're going to do a lot more of these between now and winter. In winter in northern Minnesota, you can't really survive. Some people obviously do. But if you would like to come to that camp, please do, and particularly please come sign up on here so we can send you information about it. So that's all, thank you.
Awesome, thank you so much, Cliff. Our next speaker is Isra Hirsi. She's a high school student from Minneapolis, Minnesota, a climate change and racial justice advocate who's co-founder and co-executive director of the U.S. Youth Climate Strike. She worked on getting hundreds of strikes organized across the country on March 15th and May 3rd. Hell yeah. Isra started her climate activism her freshman year of high school by joining her school's environmental club. With her identities as a Black Muslim woman in this work, she focuses on intersectionality and has been a long advocate for intersectionality and diversity within the climate justice movement, as well as in daily life.
Hi, I'm Isra. I'm a rising junior from Minneapolis. I just kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about, the intersectionality, inclusivity aspect in the climate movement. So in my intro, they mentioned how I started in my high school environmental club. And when I first joined, I was just doing a lot of random work and I just wanted to get involved in climate justice work because I wasn't before. I go to a primarily Black and brown school, but this environmental club was entirely white. It was like an hour before school started in the morning, and we all take public transportation to school, so it's like really impossible to get there on time. I was the only Black student a part of that club. And the things that we would focus on would be like recycling and things like that when there are places in Minneapolis where we have lead poisoning and really horrible air quality and things like Line 3. But we'd be focusing on things like saving the boundary waters, which is a predominantly white camp type thing that people like to go to. I've never been because it's extremely complicated. So I was a part of this really, really white club. And then from there, I ended up joining this really, really white citywide group. I don't know why I kept joining these things, but here I was. And with this group, it's called I Matter Minneapolis. I don't know if y'all heard of I Matter, but they do city resolutions to stop being climate change. And so the city resolution that we did was getting 100% renewable energy or electricity by 2040, which is entirely useless, pretty much. But, you know, passed through the city, and the city of Minneapolis is going to attempt to do that. After that group, I ended up joining another one. This one was statewide. And this statewide group was called Minnesota Can't Wait. And with this group, I also ended up being the only black person in the beginning. And it was surprising because it was supposed to be the state of Minnesota, but it was entirely kids from the suburbs. And I was like one of the only people from the city. And we would do work towards making a statewide Green New Deal. So we would be doing these actions of the governor's stuff and working with these our governor and things, even though they're really pro pipeline. And it was really interesting work for me, and I guess through these really white groups I learned that these spaces were not meant for me and they weren't going to make space for me. And with Minnesota Can't Wait, we ended up, you know, making this bill entirely youth-led, even though it was predominantly white youth, actually all white youth. And it ended up not passing because we have a Republican Senate. But this bill was supposedly a great success because it was the first statewide Green New Deal. But with this group, it ended up falling apart because of the problem of, you know, white fragility and white dominance. There was these supposed adult mentors, but they were all white individuals from the suburbs, including so many young people, you know, from the suburbs, with a small group of five or six, you know, black and brown young people, and I don't think any of them were indigenous, which is surprising in Minnesota. And so, you know, this group ended up falling apart because so many of the black and brown youth were like, this space is so toxic for me, and I never have the opportunity to get these leadership positions, and these white, this same group of white people keep taking over everything and not, you know, just inviting me to events to speak because, you know, they need that token, they need to not look like a white dominant group. And so eventually that group fell apart, I think April-ish or May, and nobody really talks about it anymore, and it just kind of just died down, I guess for the better. In January, I ended up joining or helping co-found U.S. Youth Climate Strike with my friend Haven, who's over there. And, you know, with this group, I wanted to make sure that that thing didn't happen again, where I was the only person of color, the only black individual in a space, and that I, you know, was actively working towards making sure the space was inclusive for everyone because I didn't want someone else to feel like I did. And so with U.S. Youth Climate Strike, we focused on not just, you know, making sure we can get young people to come to our events, but also making sure that communities on the front lines are aware of what's going on. And also we're understanding this is such complex language like the IPCC report. And so when March 15th came around, we created this team of young people, and I'm from Minnesota, and our group of young people accidentally ended up becoming super white because it was led by Minnesota Can't Wait, but I'll get to that. So we built this coalition of young people, we built a national team, and this team was definitely what I wanted to see. You know, it was reflective of, you know, this country and of people on the front lines. And that was extremely important and also really amazing to see because I've never seen that before. And so with the problem with Minnesota, they ended up doing an event in St. Paul, which is the capital, and they ended up we had two white organizers leading it. I guess that was my bad. But with these white individuals, they had no speakers of color, nobody talked about, not even line three, which is, again, really surprising. And so they had this completely white event, and we had so many complaints, those state leads had to take a step back. But, you know, with this step back, they were completely fine with it, and they understood what they did wrong. And I think that is the problem with so many, you know, of these white-dominated spaces, is they don't understand what they're doing wrong, and don't understand when to take a step back. And now we have, you know, a state lead that is a person of color, that is on the front lines, living in North Minneapolis with really bad air quality, and actively working against that. And I think, you know, that whole, idea of stepping back is something that we really like to focus on. You know, you look at these massive white NGOs like Greenpeace or Sierra Club or 350, and it's completely dominated by, you know, white individuals, white CEOs, etc. And there's a reason why there's not a lot of young people in that space, and also not a lot of black and brown people in those spaces. And another thing is it's super important to realize when to take that step back. And so with May 3rd. It was supposed to be another strike. The problem being is a whole bunch of countries across the world were doing it on May 24th, which is right after AP testing, but during Ramadan. And as a Muslim, I wasn't really going to try to strike during Ramadan because it just made it a little bit more complicating. And so we were the only country that advocated and did a strike on the 3rd because it was before Ramadan. And I think that also shows you another example of how dominated, the striker space is too. You look at who's dominating, and obviously, like, these people are doing amazing work, but you don't see people that look like me. You know, you look at people like Greta Thunberg, you know, and these people from these dominated white countries like Germany and like Sweden and France, but they don't even talk about places like Bangladesh or Mozambique that are actively suffering today. And so with USU Climate Strike, we really try to make sure that that happens. And a lot of the things we talk about are, you know, fossil fuels and making sure that we divest from them, and also making sure that this Green New Deal isn't just language, but also real policy that isn't just this list of ideas, but like things that actually are helping Black and Brown people in places that are, you know, currently suffering. As an individual, you know, I actively talk about these things because while I probably shouldn't be the only one talking about it, it's actively, in my mind, disrupting the space. You know, if I do an interview and I mention things like environmental racism, which you don't hear strikers talking about often, you know, that's actively disrupting the space and making people feel uncomfortable. But that discomfort is like what is necessary to like divest from this idea of white dominance and white fragility in the environmental movement, you know. Before, you know, I'm not an outdoorsy person. I don't go camping. That's not my thing. I never was like that. I don't really live near oceans, and animals aren't my priority. I care more about, you know, my life and Black and Brown people's lives, because I think that's a little bit more important. And a lot of these strikers focus more about like veganism and like polar bears and like the Atlantic Ocean, even though they live in like inland. And it's like this really frustrating rhetoric we hear so often. And, you know, thinking about your own privilege, and even me as an individual who has a home and has a place to stay and obviously has a stable income, realizing that, like, I still have the ability to, like, you know, survive, and some people don't have that ability. So understanding when it's your time to take a step back, and understanding even me with privilege, understanding that these people have their own voice and they deserve to be that voice. And I think that that is something we're all missing, a part of our own daily lives, not even just within the climate justice movement and work, but within everything and all of these spaces, because there's so many problems in the world, and we all need to understand that us as individuals are probably not suffering as much as other folks, since we all had the privilege to be here today, and be able to come here. So thank you.